He worked for the OPCW in The Hague, or the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, and he has written extensively for media outlets around the globe. He is also one of the distinguished guests at this year's second International Conference on Nuclear Disarmament here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Mr. Babrik, welcome to your program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, sir. What brought you here and what was your intention?
Well, I was invited by your government to participate and to submit a paper. But as well, your government invited me to chair the one of the three main panels for the conference on disarmament challenges. And I was very happy to accept that invitation, as I chaired the same panel last year.
You said that your main focus was going to be on the victims of chemical weapons.
At this conference, no. The focus of this conference is nuclear weapons. There has been some reference to chemical weapons and to the use of chemical weapons by Iraq against Iranians during the conference, but that's not a central theme.
Yeah. You see, now there are some accusations in the West, especially Western media outlets. They claim that Iran is organizing disarmament nuclear disarmament conferences just to somehow distract the international community's attention from the true intentions of its nuclear program. Do you think this is the case?
I think it's a load of rubbish. My view is that my view, based on my experience of two of these conferences, amongst other things, is that your government is sincere in wanting to help stimulate discussion in this region, not on nuclear proliferation, but on nuclear disarmament. Because the West and the United States have shifted the whole focus of international debate away from nuclear disarmament to the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And I think it's very, very correct for your government or any government at this stage, in that context, to encourage international debate on nuclear disarmament. So, I feel that Iran is playing a very useful role in organizing this conference.
Well, but the problem is that its program has already been politicized, and it's very difficult for Iran to get out of this vicious circle. And Iran is doing everything it can to build this kind of confidence among the international community about the true nature of its nuclear program, and nobody's listening.
Well, there's a diversity of views in the international community. There are people in Israel and the United States and elsewhere who are absolutely convinced that Iran is an evil country which is hell-bent on producing nuclear weapons, and that Iran, once it has nuclear weapons, even if only a few, undoubtedly wants to destroy the state of Israel. Amongst people who are more aware of nuclear weapons, there's another view which is quite common, and by the way, and this view is shared by Mohammed al-Baradei in that book which you're holding.
You're talking about The Age,
Age of Deception, a magnificent book. And al-Baradei is of the view, al-Baradei at present is saying that in the world there are nuclear weapon states, states of which we know they have nuclear weapons, and then there are unofficial nuclear weapon states like Israel, Pakistan, and India. But he's then saying that there are at least 13 virtual nuclear weapon states. And by this he means states which have the complete fuel cycle and which, given a political decision to go nuclear, could do so within 3 or 6 months. Amongst these virtual nuclear weapon states are countries like Japan, which is sitting on tons of enriched uranium, South Africa, Brazil, I'll just name a few. And there are many people that feel that Iran does not want to possess nuclear weapons, but Iran wants to join the ranks of these virtual nuclear weapon states. Iran wants to have the full nuclear fuel cycle, and Iran wants to be in a position. Iran is at present committed to the peaceful use of nuclear energy, but once you have the complete fuel cycle, like Japan, Brazil, and others, if you take a decision to go nuclear, you can. So both your options are open.
But as you know, the IAEA is supervising Iran's nuclear activities around the clock, and so far they have always said that there is no diversion in the civilian nature of Iran's nuclear program. But still, they always come up with this kind of double standard reports against the country, and they create hue and cry in the media that something fishy is going on behind the doors.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has been under enormous pressure from the United States and the West for years. And while Mohammed al-Baradei was Director General, he was massively attacked for holding the line, for insisting that his mandate was to inspect and to verify compliance with the NPT. And only if he found hard evidence that a country, in this case Iran, was diverting nuclear materials for military purposes, should he refer that case to the Security Council. But the problem was, at that stage, the Americans and the West became impatient with al-Baradei. So they found an excuse to take the case to the Security Council without any evidence of diversion. And in doing so, they created an entirely new precedent. It now means that the West can take a country to the Security Council without any hard evidence of the diversion of nuclear materials. And this is what's happened in the case of Iran.
About the hard evidence you just mentioned, they always claim that they have documents or so-called laptops that prove beyond any doubt that Iran's nuclear program is not peaceful. But anytime Iranian officials ask for that kind of evidence to be provided, they refuse to show that. Why is this the case? Why is this kind of behavior?
It's a political situation. It's a very political situation. There are people out there, there are governments out there that just, essentially, hate the government of Iran and are looking for ways and means of exposing Iran to international criticism. And where necessary, they are willing to fabricate evidence. We saw this in the case of Iraq. We now know that all the evidence on which the invasion of Iraq was based was fabricated by U.S. intelligence and its co-workers. In the case of Iran, what we know is that almost all the evidence, the so-called evidence, on which the case against Iran is based, has come from intelligence services of other countries, including Israel and the United States. And the laptop is a good example of this. Almost all the key allegations against Iran at present are based on information found in a laptop. No one knows for certain whose laptop this was or where it came from. In a court of law, it would have no status at all as evidence. The IAEA was given the laptop on the explicit understanding that the Iranian government would not be allowed to physically examine the laptop, because this might compromise, the sources of the intelligence. But this is like going into a court of law and in front of a judge and being told, we're going to find you guilty on the basis of this letter, but we won't allow you to see the letter because it's confidential.
You see, as you talked about the intelligence services in the United States, they have already come up with numerous reports that there has been no diversion in Iran's nuclear program, including the reports by the IAEA. And these reports came after the so-called information found in that top secret laptop.
Yeah. Well, no, the regular reports of the Americans' own intelligence agencies, and there are many intelligence agencies, and so these reports reflect the collective view of all these agencies, say there is no hard evidence that Iran intends to develop nuclear weapons. Essentially, the findings of these U.S. intelligence reports, by and large, coincide with the findings of IAEA reports. The problem with the IAEA now is that al-Baradei has gone and has been replaced by a new director general. And recently, thanks to WikiLeaks, a memorandum written by the U.S. delegation in Vienna became known. And in that at the time when there was lobbying for who should replace al-Baradei, who should be the new DG, the head of the American delegation reported back to Washington that they had talked with the current director general, the Japanese gentleman, and that he was very opposed to Iran, and therefore the U.S. would support him, his nomination for the job.
No, let's talk about Israel a little bit. The leaders in Israel, they claim that Iran is an existential threat to Israel. Let's for a moment assume that they are right and Iran has nuclear weapons or it is building nuclear weapons.
Can I interject? Again, if I may say so, this is a load of rubbish. If Iran possesses no nuclear weapons, no one claims as at present. There's no doubt about that. And Israel possesses, no one is quite sure, somewhere between 200 and 300 warheads. Plus, I should emphasize, it's not just the number of warheads that matters, it's the sophistication of the warheads. They are very sophisticated, they are state of the art. But the Israelis also have the best missiles, and the best, the most accurate, and normally American missiles, but some made by themselves. So if anybody, in the case of Iran and Iraq, if one of those countries is a threat to the other, Israel is a threat to Iran, and not the other way around.
Okay, but the problem is that the Americans are not trying to build missile defense, so-called missile defense shield, throughout Europe, allegedly to stop missiles fired from Iran. So how do you explain this situation?
Well, again, it's the Americans are trying to capitalize on anti-Iranian paranoia in Europe to get approval for this missile defense system. The Russians, for example, see it quite differently. And they ask themselves, are these missiles, American missiles, actually directed at us? We're the only nuclear rival of the United States. And are they simply using Iran as a smokescreen to justify stationing missiles along the Russian borders, right throughout Europe? And I privately think the Russians are right. The real issue is not Iran as a smokescreen. The real issue actually is that Russia has and America have the world's largest nuclear arsenals. And although relations now are moderately friendly, neither side really trusts the other. And if the Americans have nuclear-carrying missiles stationed along Russia's borders, they're in a very strong position if they get into a conflict with Russia.
Talking about Russia and the United States, what about the New START treaty that they have signed? You see, the problem the Iranian officials argue is that there is no independent body to verify there will be any true cuts in the agreements that they have made with regard to the reduction of their deployable nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. I mean, who is going to verify these cuts?
Well, one of the many strange and unfair aspects of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, is that states which want to develop nuclear energy for peaceful purposes have to agree, formally and in writing, to never-ending intrusive inspections by the IAEA to confirm their compliance, you know, and non-diversion of materials. But the P5, the nuclear weapon states, are specifically exempt from inspection. At present, there is no legal basis for any inspection of any nuclear facility in any one of the nuclear weapon states. So essentially, they can do whatever they like with their arsenals. They can enhance the lethality of their missiles, of their weapons, of their warheads. They can improve the missiles. They can develop the capability, they can improve it, but no external agency can monitor or check or inspect what they're doing. So in the end, we have to take what they tell us about their own nuclear weapons, as true. Whereas they insist on not taking as true everything which we say about our nuclear program.
Talking about the UNSC, the United Nations Security Council, you know, five countries have veto power. Do you think that Iran is right in complaining that this is not a fair system at this point in time?
The power balance on the UN Security Council reflects the world roughly as it was in 1945. So I think that's my answer to your question. The world has changed somewhat since 1945, and the UN Security Council no longer reflects the world of today. It's also, for a start, the composition of the P5. At the end of World War II, France and the United Kingdom were not superpowers, but they were still major powers. In today's world, they're not. They don't really belong in the Security Council at all. And the other question is the right of veto. I privately think that the power for any group of states to have the power of veto over decisions is simply, it gives that state or those states far too much power. They can strangle debate at the highest level.
You wrote an interesting article, I read it couple of days ago, in which you predicted that because of the Arab uprisings, there will be a different Middle East, which is going to oppose the policies of the United States, its allies, and especially Israel.
Yeah.
And you said that they are going to have a greater say, the Arab world, in the new world order. Do you still believe that this is going to be the case?
Well, it's still early days. It's still not clear what exactly is happening in the Arab world. So do we really have a revolution in Egypt where the military is still firmly in control? Do we have a revolution in Bahrain? Do we have a revolution in Saudi Arabia? Do we have a real revolution in Jordan, Tunisia, and of course Yemen, where the current political leadership is hanging on to power with the active support of Saudi Arabia and I suspect of the United States as well. So if you look around yourself at present, the first thing is to what extent can you speak accurately of a revolution in the Middle East? There's no doubt there's turmoil and unrest, and there's no doubt that political leaders in the Middle East are learning, possibly for the first time in recent decades, that they actually have to take their own public seriously. that is something new. But at this stage, it appears as though the old regime is hanging on to power.
What about Iran? What is this going to do to Iran and its position in the new Middle East?
Well, I think the fundamental thing is, there are two things. One is I think that Egypt, under its new leadership, is going to become a major player in the Middle East again, as it was under Nasser. So it'll become very important for Egypt and Iran to build a friendly relationship, which didn't exist under Mubarak. And there are already indications that, although in the past there's been tension between Egypt and Iran, both governments are now working at building a new and friendlier relationship. And I think that's good. So Iran and Turkey, who have been key players, have now been joined by Egypt. But also just quietly, Saudi Arabia is emerging as a major power. They're trying to wield influence throughout the region to prevent change, to block change. And they're pouring money into, they're sending their own troops into Bahrain, they're pouring money. The United Arab Emirates has spent billions of dollars setting up a private army, recruited with the assistance of the United States, which is clearly available to put down rebellions in countries of, the Gulf states. So, and the Saudis are pouring money into Egypt, for example, so-called aid. But aid and assistance always comes with strings. So Saudi Arabia is also emerging, and this is deepening divisions throughout the Middle East between Sunni and Shia. And I'm kind of worried personally at present that what began as a revolution in the name of democracy is in certain parts of the Middle East beginning to turn into a fairly familiar and bitter confrontation between Shia and Sunni.
But if you remember, Iran's policy so far has been non-interference in the internal affairs of the regional states. And Iran refuses this idea, this argument that this is something between Shia and Sunni, especially in a place such as Bahrain. Sure. And it's got more to do with democracy. I read in your articles, one of your articles, you also mentioned that this has nothing to do with Islamic revolution. This has everything to do with democracy and people wanting to free themselves from these autocratic regimes.
That's true. That's how it began. But by intervening in Bahrain and quashing the rebellion, the Shia were the people who are rising up against the Sunni royalty in Bahrain. Now hostility between the Sunni leadership of the country and the people, all those people who are Shia, is being inflamed. And what began as a movement for democracy is now increasingly, I'm not saying solely, taking on a Sunni Shia character. And already, for example, in Iraq, you see Shia demonstrating in support of Shia in Bahrain. I mean, the potential is there for this to spread throughout the region.
I think this got to do with the harsh treatment, rather, ethnic background or being a Shia or Sunni. I think anybody who watches these terrible scenes on TV, they feel bad about the whole situation. So I think Iran has the right to somehow reflect on the harsh reality that is happening in these countries and complain to these regimes that you have to stop, this kind of brutal crackdown against your own people. Iran always says your own people. This got to do with democracy, not Shias or Sunni. And in Bahrain, especially in the case of Bahrain, we also see Sunni demonstrators on the streets.
Oh, sure.
And what about Egypt? They are all Sunnis. What about Tunisia? They are all Sunnis. They are not Shias.
No. I'm saying is that my concern is that especially in Bahrain, it's beginning to take on a sectarian character. When they crush the rebellion, what happens is the Sunni leadership is turning on the people who mainly are Shia. And the very fact that in Iraq you had lots of public demonstrations in support of, by Shia, by the way, by Iraqi Shia, not Sunni, in support of Shia in Bahrain proves that. That's all.
You are an expert in international affairs, especially non-proliferation and disarmament. Mm. You see, there is this kind of buying frenzy going on in the Persian Gulf states. They are buying each and every year. They spend billions of dollars to buy new weapons from the United States and its allies. And they are all doing these things to justify the so-called non-existent Iranian threat. Do you think that there is this kind of threat on the part of Iran towards these neighbors?
There's no evidence of any hostile or aggressive intent on the part of Iran. People who demonize Iran assume that, that Iran, you know, is aggressive, but there's actually no hard evidence that that Iran has any intention of attacking any neighboring country.
You are a distinguished guest at this year's International Disarmament Conference here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. How do you find this meeting? Where is this meeting going? Do you see anything positive coming out?
This is the second of these meetings. Last year I was at the first conference, and when I look back on that conference, I thought, this is my own theory, by the way, but that conference took place about 5 or 6 weeks before the NPT review conference in New York. And at that NPT review conference, the Middle East worked together very effectively in the face of fierce pressure from the US and the West to fight for a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. And they made it clear, in the end, they made it clear to the US that if the US didn't back down over that, the whole conference would fail. And the US backed down and approved a kind of watered-down request. I feel that the experience of being together in Tehran 6 weeks before the NPT review conference and sharing views and reaching agreement helped the Middle Eastern states to hang together at the NPT review conference. So therefore it was politically important.
And this
year's conference, I think, is a continuation of that. It's more streamlined. It's been really interesting. The people who are there, the participants, are enjoying it. The presentations, there's a lot of communication going on, real communication. At a lot of international meetings, people don't communicate. People talk at each other. They don't talk with each other. They don't engage with each other. And there's a lot of engagement going on. And I'm very happy with the diversity of the participants. There are all kinds of interesting people with interesting ideas from academia, from the non-governmental community, and also from governments. And it all adds up to a very interesting mix. And I think at this stage, in my view, the conference is a success.
Apart from few experts from New York, like last year, the American government did not send any official to this year's meeting. What is your take on that?
It
was an open invitation for any country. They were all invited to come, even the United States.
My own country didn't come, although they could have come. It's again just part of the demonization of Iran. At present, the US is unhappy with everything which your government represents and does. So where they can, they boycott everything which it does and organizes and stands for and encourages its allies to do the same. They want to isolate Iran.
About this containment strategy, they know that they always admit and acknowledge that they have failed. But I'm asking this simple question. What if Iran scrapped its nuclear program, its civilian nuclear program, and says that I'm going to give up everything that you ask? Do you think that after that they are going to change their policy towards Iran?
No, they would find something else to complain about. There's a deeply rooted hostility between the government of the United States and the government of Iran, which seems, it goes back to 1979, the occupation of the embassy, which the Americans have never forgotten. They felt humiliated. And also, by the way, they lost when the Shah left, they lost control of Iran, and the Shah was replaced. The Shah had been collaborating with the Americans in every and Israel in every respect. This gave the Americans great power over the Middle East as well as control over Iran's oil and gas. They lost all of this. So I think it's a combination of these two factors.
Where do you see the International Conference on Nuclear Disarmament going? Where do you think this is going to end up? Iran has started.
First of all, Iran has indicated at this meeting they want to continue annually with this, and I think this is a very good thing. I think that in the context of a world dominated by the West and its agenda of counter-proliferation, it's a very healthy development for Iran to continue to focus on nuclear disarmament. And these meetings are just one very helpful way of drawing attention to the importance of that.
Bobby, thank you for being in your own program, and I wish you a very good stay in here in the Iranian capital, Tehran.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.